jump scare. You thought we were done with this season, but we had one last spooky surprise for you. Hello, listeners. Happy Halloween, and welcome to episode number 179 of Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. This is also episode number 4 of Monster by the Month, where we talk about all of Marvel's 1970s horror comics in chronological order. My name is Tomb of Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Giant-Sized Man-Thing Milne.
And I'm Marvel Spotlight on Jamie Wenger.
All of the issues that we're going to talk about came out between March and May 1972. And fellas, I think it's fair to say that we are starting to hit a critical mass of Marvel monster comics, a real monster mash, if you will.
I will.
Yeah, will indeed.
Excellent. Thank you. In this episode, just this episode alone, we're going to talk about a werewolf, a swamp monster, and two different vampires, among other ghosts and ghouls and devils and demons and things that go bump in the night. I'm very excited to be reaching this point in Marvel history where the monsters are taking over. It kind of feels like this is what's happening in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well this year. So we're accidentally topical again. We did it.
Just have to wait long enough.
They really are with the licenses they have or don't have, Marvel has been following almost the comics model of like introducing each character, bringing together the Avengers, like every step of the way. Then and guess what, there's Asgard and there's space, and now they're like, and also there's horror, and this is very exciting. I mean, there have been dabbles in this, but not by Marvel themselves, because Nick Cage, he's been around some Marvel characters.
And obviously, I mean, you know, the biggest movie of this summer was Morbius. Morbian time all day long, for so many days and weeks and months. I mean, really, it's still Morbin time in my heart. Right behind that was Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, which of course was directed by the legendary Sam Raimi, horror auteur.
Yeah, I just rewatched it. It counts as a horror movie.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's Evil Dead and Scarlet Witch. It's terrific.
Man, when she's walking down that tunnel, that was great. Like her like monster limp and the red eyes, and it was so
fun. Possessing her other self. Yeah.
Yes.
And then of course, Werewolf by Night dropped on Disney Plus at the start of October. And folks, look, if you have not seen Werewolf by Night, if you haven't seen that yet and you don't want to be spoiled, I would really honestly suggest that you just pause this episode right now, watch that, and then come on back.
It's only like 45 minutes. You can handle it. Like,
Yeah. And it's like, come on, this episode is dropping on Halloween. If you have not seen Werewolf by Night yet, I think you really need to reexamine some of your life choices.
Agreed.
Yeah. No, it was just, I know we talked about this a little bit at the end of the last episode, but like, I was just so pleased with how, like, right from the very beginning, where it was set up as like a special presentation, where it felt like, you know, a special network TV movie event from the 80s, like, you know, when we grew up.
That title card is
That like HBO where the spotlights all come together to make the HBO logo, and there's that like epic music. It definitely harkened back to those days.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, it's also like, I love with Disney Plus, like they don't have to fit into time slots anymore, you know, like they can make the thing as long as the thing needs to be, and they can tell different stories of different lengths. And it's just, I honestly, like, I think they totally made the most of it. Like, I think if that Werewolf by Night, I think if it had been like 20 minutes longer or 20 minutes shorter, it would not have been satisfying. But like, that was just, it was just the perfect amount of this just really cool pastiche or tribute to, you know, some of these classic like Hammer horror, Universal monster movies.
Yeah. And it's such a, it walks such a tightrope of being like get like scary horror, but it's not scary horror because like I can't handle that stuff and I had a great time watching it, you know. You know, but it's not that, you know. I keep thinking about my parents and like, will they enjoy it when I inevitably force them to watch it? And I think the answer is it doesn't matter because I'm going to make them watch it.
And they should. It's not like hilariously funny, but it does fit in those, in like an Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, Shaun of the Dead kind of thing, where there are horror elements, very exquisitely defined horror elements, and so many references and homages, but they're done in just a tongue-in-cheek way that makes it like, you know, it feels like so much of Marvel where it just feels like your friends telling you a story, you know?
Right. It's like spooky campfire stories.
Yeah. Horror can be fun. It doesn't have to be something that you need to run away from.
And there's some really good gags in this too. So it's just,
oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and seeing the man thing showing up, like it was amazing to like, I love that critter. And you know, it's like for the longest time, either there was like no awareness of the fact that Marvel had a character called the Man Thing, or, you know, it was just the joke was giant size man thing. And then that was the extent of it, you know?
Yeah. Right.
But it's like, it's such a great design. Like I love that, that Gray Moreau design of the creature. And you know, it's like such a classic type of comic book character. And like, look, I love Swamp Thing. And this, you know, we've talked about this in the past when Man-Thing first showed up, but you know, there was probably some cross pollination, no pun intended, of, you know, the creation of those two characters, because
with the creators living together and
Jerry Conway and Len Wein were living together as roommates. So, you know, but it was really cool to like finally see that character sort of get his due. And, you know, to have them find something interesting to do with him, because, you know, up until very recently, there wasn't a lot of that in the comics. So,
He's by far the coolest designed swamp monster. Like his look is, I mean, I love Swamp Thing, and I think Man Thing is like, I don't know, two more stars.
He's a mossy Snuffleupagus.
Yeah, yeah.
And who knew? I didn't know that. That was such a big surprise.
Yeah. And it's great. And it's just like, and the whole, like the conceit of the character, like the whatever knows fear burns at the touch of the man thing, is like such a cool.
You know, and also the music, man, it starts off with a campy horror version. I mean, perfectly done of the Marvel theme, of course, by the director who also made the Marvel theme. So
cut his teeth on Lost.
Yeah. God, it's going to be so long before I outlive that.
I hope someday we get to talk to Dave.
I'm going to have to make him like a diorama somehow of him, like with his teeth getting cut by, I don't know how you would do that, but
a little, just a little timeline of his greatest hits. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and you know, for being called Werewolf by Night, it was actually a pretty significant departure from, you know, the titular werewolf, you know, as far as the comics are concerned. Like the Jack Russell in that is very unlike the Jack Russell that we've seen so far in the comics, but I like it, you know. It's an interesting take. I'm interested to see what they wind up doing with the character.
That's the other thing, they like kicked open a door like with this, and it's just it's wide open plains, and who knows what comes after this. Like, does it look anything like this? I can't imagine that it would, but maybe, and that would be awesome.
There's three major characters. I mean, Elsa Bloodstone, Man Thing, and Werewolf by Night. All just fully realized in this very short film, and really setting the stage. Like, I keep dreaming about what they're going to do next with the sort of Marvel horror universe, because they kicked it wide open. I mean, I do love that they just sort of bring you in with a more mature Jack Russell, as we've been reading. Jax exploits as a teenager after his body went through changes and hair started growing in places that
hadn't. That is a pretty big metaphor to like sidestep, like for the character. So the movie won't, I presumably won't really play with that.
Yeah, I think.
Or like whatever comes next, I mean.
Yeah, like he's already part of like a team of monsters at this point, you know?
Right.
It's just great. They start there. They can backstory this sometime if they want, but I think that's just a better way to go. Like you don't need a whole bunch of background on dude turns into a werewolf.
He's a werewolf. What more do you want?
Yeah, right. Wait, what do you mean? Oh, full moon. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jamie, this all feels like a very natural transition into talking about our first issue of the evening, starring Jack Russell, the werewolf by night. Would you care to let us know what he has been up to?
Sure, with great pleasure. This will be Marvel Spotlight 4, Island of the Damned, written by Jerry Conway, art by Mike Ploog.
Before you get going, I had this thought when I was doing some of the notes for this episode that I think the best 70s horror comics have story titles that could also be a 70s punk band song.
That's so great.
I think Island of the Damned, yeah, absolutely. Man, that could be a Misfits song, no problem.
Yeah, even the Isle of the Doomed, which it says on the cover. Which is different than what they say as normal Marvel comics go.
I wonder if they were nervous about putting damn on the cover.
Oh, I bet they were, for sure. Yeah.
Probably heckin' nervous.
Nice. So, we start with writer and nighttime sneak Buck Cowan sneaking around Jack's property looking for information about the famously evil but nonfiction book, The Darkhold. Instead, he sort of surprises Jack about the sale of an old family castle that was sold to a man named Blackar.
This is not the only castle real estate transaction in this episode of horror comics.
Right. And not to be confused with Blackagar. That's a totally different first name. Yeah,
his last name is not Boltagon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, what a weird name to encounter almost twice in a...
Somebody just thought, Jerry's like, I just thought of this. This is such a cool name.
Right, right. So this Blackar guy, he apparently had the castle taken apart brick by brick and moved to be rebuilt on an island. So a bold, expensive proposition. Mm-hmm. So then Jack and Buck, they decide to kind of team up to get to the castle by stealing his dad's step boat. The plan kind of falls apart. So then it just ends up with Jack being alone on the boat. He's the only one that can go on this. So while he's there, a storm hits, which causes Jack to suffer injuries and the boat to take on water. I thought this was cool because werewolves and water are a pretty weird combo. So like, of course, he's going to be bad at it and gets hurt.
Sure.
Right. I couldn't think of another instance where they're like werewolf on boat. That doesn't ring any
they
bells.
They get too soggy. They're waterlogged. Yeah,
the fur smells. It's just nasty.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Gonna need a bigger werewolf.
I want to see werewolf fight a shark. So thanks for putting that in my head.
It's only a matter of time before that comes up on the roulette wheel at sci-fi, right?
Right. Yeah. It should have come up before Sharknado by like 100 versions of that wheel.
Yeah.
Those knuckleheads. We'll see what they crank out next. So anyway, Jack's more or less adrift until tank top enthusiast Garth rescues Jack. But instead of like just a clean rescue, he scuttles the boat and keeps Jack at gunpoint for the rest of the trip.
Yeah, he scuttles it by shooting it with like a machine gun. So he doesn't mess around with scuttling it. And it's obvious he's not like a super friendly chap.
Yes. Yeah. I also love the word scuttle, and I was so happy to see it in use, but sad that our hero suffered because of it.
Yeah. But honestly, he was not great at driving that boat. So it's probably for the best.
Yeah, it could have gone a lot worse, I guess. So at this point in the story, some of the visual techniques that we've seen in play, they start to kind of make a little bit more sense. So the shadowing that we were seeing in some of these like fairly innocent adventure things start to like make more sense in the context of the story as it's unfolding. Things feel a little bit tighter. And there's like a vague sense of uncomfortableness. I don't think I'm making that up. I think it's there.
No, there is definitely a creeping dread.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the shots are shots that you would see in horror movies too. You see like a a long shot down a staircase with shadows. You see people backlit ominously as you're meeting them. Like, it's just from below. So yeah, there's just a ton of cinematic elements going on. Plugness.
I love thinking about how that, like, those techniques that they work in film and they work in comics, like, they work for probably a fundamental reason. Like, it's not like, oh, we're used to this language that we're getting from film and now we're seeing it in comics and that sentiment is translating over. It's like, there's something inherent about doing things like this that feels a certain way. And I thought that's cool.
I think how you frame things, who's closer, who's further away, all those kinds of things. They've been done in illustration, you know, long before photography even. So it's
right. Yeah. I find that exciting that it's not associative. It's not because we associate a shot that looks like this with horror that we feel horror. It's just it's native.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anywho, so they get to the island. They meet Miles Blackar and his daughter Marlene. Miles looks more or less like a sort of a Coen Brothers old banking guy, while Marlene looks strikingly like a redhead version of Rene Russo in Get Shorty, complete with the sunglasses.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
She totally does. We learn that Miles is running an island, in quotes, institution, and has patients. And while they're sort of meeting and greeting, a man who looks to be like an escaped convict of some kind emerges from the bushes. He's raving about not wanting to be changed. So our man Garth knocks him out, and no one really makes much of this.
That's how you handle things at the institution. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, these guys are professionals. They know how to handle things. So later, Marlene and Jack, they're having a hang session. She says a bunch of things that are both cryptic and maybe borderline incriminating. And she's kind of nicely cleaning his boat wounds. You know, she's super cool because she's still wearing sunglasses indoors like a boss. Jack says he's looking for this book, The Darkhold, and Marlene indicates that her father would kill him to keep it. But she agrees to help him anyway. She seems to be taking Jack's side. She's a rebel. Look at those glasses. Then her dad comes in, though, and he's saying there's some kind of emergency. It requires her attention. So off the two of them go. Miles locks Jack up in the room for his own safety. And look, pro tip, if anyone ever locks you in somewhere for your safety, get out.
Yeah. Yep.
That never goes well.
Unless, you are in a mental institution and, you know, under watch.
Or... Even still.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Right. we've seen that go bad a number of times.
True. True. Yeah. Especially if you're in a fictitious environment. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter if I'm in a mental institution, I'm trying to get out of that straitjacket again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you could do it.
Say again.
Those doctors think they're so smart.
Vaccine my ass.
I know how to Houdini some keys into my gums. okay, sorry.
So anyway, Jack, he knows all this, so he escapes from the room. He goes out through the window, kind of swinging up and around. And then he sort of semi-secretly observes from above this horrible mad scientist-looking room with a horrible operation that goes so horribly wrong that it leaves a patient without a mouth. We don't get to see it exactly, but we see Jack's response to it. Must be extra freaky because I think it makes him kind of cry, right? Aren't there tears? I think there are tears.
Yeah, or sweat, or it's either flop sweat or tears. But yeah, he's definitely having an intense physical reaction.
Yeah, so this is like real gnarly. But while he's up there, he finds the Darkhold. Problem solved. But just as he starts to browse the page, or maybe because of it, he notices that he's starting to transform. The full moon appears, and it's werewolf o'clock.
Love this transition at the top of page 11.
It is very cool. It's outside of any panel frame. Mm-hmm. So it's seamless with the white border. And there's I counted maybe 7 to 10 human to wolf, transitional shapes, they're overlapping. So it's not they're not individual. They're just,
and they come from shadow into color as it comes to you. There's 8 forms. It's a really cool transformation scene.
Yeah.
It's kaleidoscopic feeling. It feels so much like drugs.
Yeah.
It's like you're watching a time lapse occur, and
totally
they did it in a very new way. Yeah.
I wish that there was more opportunity for stuff like that in the story, but there's only one moment where he's going to transform,
Right. Yeah.
two if your story goes on too long, I assume. So then he immediately trashes the lab because werewolves are the opposite of science. So they're
gonna, they hate science.
They hate science.
Stupid science.
Yep. So Jack evades gun enthusiast Garth. He frees the rest of the quote unquote patients who have all been turned into pretty shockingly monstrous forms.
Yeah, it's a real Dr. Moreau situation.
This is completely. I just reread League of Extraordinary Gentlemen too, where they eventually visit a Moreau guy named Moreau who is doing this. But because in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is bringing together a bunch of fiction heroes or villains or whatever, but from certain eras, and this is like exactly doing the same jam. It's really cool. Huh.
Oh, that is interesting. So then all the like monster people have been freed. So then Garth tries to shoot them all, but then Werewolf Jack and kind of the Beast Brigade, they all attack Garth. And then the beasts eventually kind of mob over him in sort of your classic, like, overwhelmed by zombie style.
And also in that panel, the top panel of page 15, that's where Garth finally realizes you're a werewolf.
It's a drinking time for our Werewolf by Night podcast.
That's part of the...
Yeah, our Bronze Age monsters, I should say.
Yep. They would be taking a drink here. Also, I think it's right around here. Yeah, the very next panel. The werewolf's thinking, no fight here, too many walls, too many men watching, staring, must leave, find the forest. Yes, I must find the forest.
Yeah, so right.
It's a double shot.
Wow. Yep. Okay.
This, the killing of Garth is kind of like what we saw in Luke Cage. So you're getting this sort of, I think it's called moral relativism, where like, this is satisfying justice, like, like good has been done, but this isn't like super heroic justice. This isn't like hero justice. Like, they just kind of murdered a dude.
It's more horror hero justice, but
Right. Like EC Comics, like, you know, the zombie has come back to murder the person who killed him.
Sort of thing. Iron Man doesn't typically do this.
No, not typically. But it'd be a lot cooler if he did. He just kills his employees when they have mental health crises.
Or try and get control of his company. So then Werewolf Jack, he makes his way towards Marlene's shadow. And Marlene's shadow is now like classic horror movie dress. She's holding the, like, I think it's candelabra. I think that's what you call it, where it's like a candlestick, but there's like three or four of them. I think this is a classic monster trope where you get like a primal wolf or monster man in like savage form being like calmed and soothed by like a feminine force.
Your
King Kongs and such.
Your Hulks.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There you go.
This might ring more of a bell for you, buddy.
Right. So she leads Werewolf Jack to Miles, who sort of understandably shoots at the werewolf that's lunging towards him. And they have a bit of a fight until Jack throws him out of the window. Which again, this is like, again, it's satisfying and technically justified, but not, you know, not what Spider-Man does.
Also, the Werewolf by Night guys would say this is another occasion. Because breaking glass. So,
Right.
So check that off on your bingo cards.
It's got everything.
Yeah.
This is a classic Werewolf by Night episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Next time I gotta get that list going. Keep taking shots and such.
Yep. Although, I mean, it is their bit. Maybe.
As long as
we're, you know, making sure to give credit where credit's due.
Right. They're not too litigious.
Yet.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. They're getting pretty big time though. We got to be careful. Yeah. We don't want a Harlan Ellison situation on our hands.
Again. I'm just going to keep throwing one word on the end of whatever we say.
So Marlene, she's still wearing sunglasses, comms the Savage Wolfman. She unloads. It's kind of an info dump here. We get a lot of information. So we get that Jack's done what she wanted, meaning the murder of her father. We find out she was next to be experimented on and that her father was driven mad by the way that her mother died. So at this point, she's sort of manipulating a force of nature, but maybe in self-preservation, you know, this is teetering towards the reveal.
Yep.
But then her fingers touch him and he freaks out and slaps her away. and just pause for a sec. Is there a thing where, not pause the podcast, pause for, I have a question. It's
like, stop listening, everybody.
Yeah. Go about your business. I have to ask them a question. is there a thing where he doesn't like to be touched by humans, or do werewolves not like to be touched kindly? Like, is that a thing?
I don't know that they love being touched.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's a specific thing, but usually it, like any sort of beast monster, if you're, they're more likely to whack you than to let you touch them. So if you try to do that, it's rare. And, but it seems like this was something more, like there was some kind of power.
He was unnerved by this for some reason.
Yeah.
But she's got a bad, like an extremely bad vibe.
Yeah. I see. So he gets that through the touch because he's sensitive, because he's nature sensitive. Okay,
there you go.
I got you. He's nature. Oh, we got there.
He's a sensitive nature boy.
So anyway, as he freaks out, he knocks her glasses away, revealing her like eyeless eyes. They're just blank. And so then it's her turn to freak out now. And she says even more stuff. And they get kind of progressively more troubling. So the first one is, she says that Jack has betrayed her in the same way her father did, I guess with violence, and that her father wanted to change her too, you know, not super cool, that she was the cause of her father's experiments, interesting, and that her mother died giving birth to her, a mutant freak. And then we're like, oh no. Yeah, so she's bad news. We then pull out to see a foggy courtyard where presumably real people have been turned to stone statues, just like Jack has been, by her. She's a Medusa.
Oh my goodness.
Gordon. But not that Medusa.
Yeah.
Oh, not that Medusa. Right. Yes. Yeah. Even though she is a black agar.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. Weird. With red hair too.
Too many Inhumans references. Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. And of course the Inhumans wind up being replacement mutants for a time. Yeah. So,
whoa.
Yeah. So it's all cyclical, man. It's all tied together. Yeah.
I did love that we've got the island of Dr. Moreau, a Gorgon, or a Medusa, as the Draculas like to say. And, and this mention of mutants, and of course a werewolf, you know, driving the whole title. So it's just a trifecta, maybe a quinfecta. I don't know how that works.
Quince. The scariest part, I mean, it's not like it's a spooky issue, but what becomes unnerving, or at least was to me, was the final narration. Like he's still, his inner monologue is still cranking along, even though he's stuck in the swamp.
Yeah.
And that's the true horror, you know, like,
yeah,
so he's a cool statue. He's a werewolf, and you know he didn't get turned back to a person, so it's a cool werewolf statue. Mm-hmm. If he's gonna stay that way, the title might suffer, but
yeah,
still look good.
Yeah, this title's gotten really stationary recently. This doesn't seem to be moving.
Yeah, and I'm just loving the way Ploog's art is evolving. Also, like especially when you see, you know, the dungeon full of all the experimental subjects.
Oh yeah.
Just like, you know, 20 different shades of grotesque. It's really
well, and the way that they're layered too.
It
goes from the foreground to the background. It's just like it's monsters all the way down. Like
there's
like you can't see the walls.
Colon on methamphetamines. It's awesome. Yeah. It's just like I'm gonna draw more. Yeah.
Big old pile of monsters.
All the shots of his hair, well, not all the shots, but some of the like the close-ups of the hair. There's like so much fine detail. Mm-hmm. On page 20 on the right is the really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a good time reading this one. I was a little like confused in the beginning with the, once I got to the island, I feel like the story kind of straightened out in the beginning. Yeah,
the boat part had to just like, we got to wedge this in the plot so we can get to an island with the guy making monsters. Come on.
Who's this reporter? Who owns the boat? What's the sailor dude doing there? Yeah, the first four pages were a little rough, but then it kind of snapped into place.
Yeah, then it just sings.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some more comics.
Dracula and his tomb of Dracula.
Draculia.
This story is called Who Stalks the Vampire? B plus punk song title. So this is the third issue of Tomb of Dracula that we've covered. The first one is that has been written by Archie Goodwin. So that's
promising.
It's drawn by Gene Colan, as is every issue of Tomb of Dracula, and inks, of course, by the MVP Tom Palmer. So this issue opens with a guilt-ridden Frank Drake about to throw himself off of what I believe is the old London Bridge. I compared some pictures on Google, and
oh wow,
I think I've got it.
yeah, we've got Big Ben back there. That's a pretty good indicator.
Yeah, so yeah, we know that we're in London because it's a bridge and it's got Big Ben in the background.
Plus the fog. I mean, plus I the fog.
Yeah, it's. That's 100%. We know a lot about England. I think our knowledge is going to come out as we go through this this recap.
Yeah. Some people might mistake us for Englandologists, but yep. We don't have degrees in Englandology. No, at least I don't. I'm speaking for myself.
Mastery of the language, obviously.
Top of the morning to you, Governor.
There you go.
Yep. That's
like looking in an English mirror.
Yep. Yeah, so Frank Drake, he's going to throw himself off the bridge. He can't bear the memory of staking his late fiancée, Jeannie, no last name, whom his ancestor Dracula transformed into a vampire. But just as he leaps into the Thames below, he's caught by an Indian man named Taj, who's acting under the orders of Rachel Van Helsing, the great-granddaughter of the man who slayed Dracula temporarily.
Cool.
They drive off in Rachel's Rolls Royce, and the scene switches to Drake's frenemy Cliff Graves getting kicked out of a pub at closing time. He's terrified to head out into the foggy London streets, and with good reason. Dracula is there waiting for him. Graves heads back to the hotel where he and Drake first stayed upon coming to England to try and recover Dracula's coffin for his new master. But as he descends into the basement with the night porter, Rachel, Drake, and Taj pull up outside and arm themselves for vampire combat.
Cool. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yep. Just like opening the trunk and there's crucifixes and stakes and it's like, we're ready to go.
I didn't think there was anything this cool, like rolling up in a Rolls Royce. And like, this seems like a trope that happens later in films with vampires, but this seemed like the sweet badass montage where they all like gear up with stake, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer kind of would do something like this. So it was ahead of its time.
Yeah. It even is like the serious version of the Edgar Wright, like quick assembly, like, you know, like everyone's like unpacking stuff.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, she's a professional. She's got generations of experience, so she knows what she's doing. In the basement, Cliff and the porter are carrying Dracula's coffin out when it slips from the porter's hands and smashes to the ground, revealing a false bottom filled with gold coins. The night porter tries to grab one as it rolls to a stop at the feet of Dracula. Mm. The porter begs Cliff for help, but he is thoroughly zombified. He is not going to be any help.
Yeah, he's hypnotized. Just to be clear, he's
Dracula. Oh, yeah, that is
the whammy. I realize we're talking about monsters, so I don't literally mean zombie. Yes.
Well, in England, they call zombies vampires and other way around. So that's why.
Right, yeah, right. So yeah,
he was speaking as an Englandologist.
Yep.
Zed something. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Indeed.
The Z word. We cut away to our intrepid vampire hunters who hear the scream of the night porter and arrive just in time to find him dead in Dracula's coffin. Dracula and Cliff try to ambush them, but Drake holds his undead ancestor at bay with a cross. But because Cliff is not a vamp, he's just hypnotized. He's able to sock Drake in the face and remove the threat of the crucifix. Dracula thinks he's got the drop on them now, but Rachel pulls out a crossbow with a wooden tipped bolt and narrowly misses impaling Dracula with it as he transforms into a bat and flies away. So our hero's pursuit of the diabolical vamp is cut short by the police, which they call bobbers in England. That's what they call the police. And to be fair, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt here. There's a dead porter in a coffin, and the only other folks around are holding like medieval weapons. And talking
it doesn't look great.
Yeah, they're talking spooky nonsense.
Yeah, they're not trying to like come up with an excuse. They're like, nope, we're hunting Dracula. And they're like, all right, just give me some of your drugs. Yeah.
They weren't like, oh, we were changing a light bulb and this guy was standing on the thing and he like, oh, he got shocked and the light burned into his face. That's why he's so pale. And he fell over and this box happened to be here. Like,
yeah,
nope. There was no Three's Companying that.
Yeah. None of that. And also, like, Taj is, he's a giant and he never speaks. So, like, everything about these people is suspicious.
Right.
So everyone winds up getting hauled off to Scotland Yard, where they spend the next several hours trying to convince Inspector Chelm that they didn't murder the porter. Meanwhile, the mesmerized Cliff is driving a truck, which they call a Lawrence in England, with Dracula's coffin in the back of it.
Also, I just, in case anyone younger is listening, please don't drive hypnotized. It's not safe. You need to be fully alert to drive a vehicle. Just be careful out there.
That's good. That's one of our PSAs for the month that we got done.
Now we're covered.
Yeah. We're working off that community service one at a time. He traded in Drax gold coins for native currency, which of course in England are hay pennies. His new master is sleeping comfortably above his native soil, and they are on their way to the person who purchased Castle Dracula from Frank Drake, who inherited it, if you remember. Back at the morgue, the night porter, remember him? He's rising from the slab with brand new vampire fangs.
Yeah.
But he doesn't get a chance to use them because Rachel Van Helsing is waiting for him with a crucifix. And the rest of Team Van Helsing surrounds the porter and stakes him, with Inspector Chelm looking on in horrified disbelief. And this is enough to turn him into a vamp believer.
Yeah.
And he pledges Scotland Yard's support. I was surprised and impressed with the quick turn here. It's like, oh, okay, you guys were totally telling the truth. You have the support of this large law enforcement institution now.
Yeah, I do like that plan, though, which is, you don't believe us, let's all go to the morgue together and wait for this guy to seriously, he's going to rise from the dead and we're going to kill him and you're going to believe us. And he's like, oh, let's hang out in the morgue. Let's, you know, it's not, I'm not a judge. The court will allow it, though.
Yeah, it's just it's really efficient storytelling and it saves countless issues of them like trying to convince the police that they're not the bad guys over and over again. They're just like, we're not doing that this time. Like,
which is the worst part of every horror movie. Mm-hmm. Like every monster movie is like, really, vampires, you know, like, is there ever been a scene like that where you've wanted to see more of it and see it go on longer? You know?
Right.
Yeah.
I just want more disbelief. I want 20 minutes of disbelief.
Yeah.
While other people get killed. It's very frustrating. Yes.
Yeah, where preventable murders are happening. So Scotland Yard is on their side. Is that going to be enough to stop Dracula before he kills again? Well, probably not, because he and Cliff have already made it to the spooky, stately manor of Ilsa Strangeway? Strangway?
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 Strongway?
You want to say Strongway? Let's say Strongway.
This is an A, but let's just say Strangway.
Strangway. Okay. Her lawyer, and of course in England, they call those salacious crumbs. He says that he's got someone who wants to buy Castle Dracula, which she herself just purchased from Frank Drake. But Ilsa tells Godfrey Langston, that he shouldn't have bothered because she's never, ever selling that castle. And the reason is she is convinced that magic and the occult are the secret to restoring her lost youth and beauty, especially Dracula magic. Langston leaves and the balcony doors blow open with drama queen Dracula standing just beyond them.
Yeah. Oh, we should also say that it's obvious that Ilsa made her living up on being a model. There's paintings and portraits, you know, it's like almost a Dorian Gray kind of thing. She's now aged and she can't stand it at all. So they really do sell that pretty well in a very short amount of time.
As what's his name? As Langston is going through the home, like he's commenting on, it's like, oh, she was beautiful when she was younger. Like, cause there's all these, I mean, she's also a very vain woman, obviously, cause there's paintings and portraits of her all the way through.
Yeah.
It felt a little like Havisham-y, right? Great Expectation. Like this woman thinking back on her glory days in this mansion filled with like stuff.
Yeah. And she's not, I mean, Gene Colan's drawing her, so you know, she's not horrific.
She's
you know,
aged very well.
She looks great.
Yeah, she looks like middle aged. Basically, she looks like a good looking middle aged woman. But I mean, maybe that also kind of accentuates kind of out of her tree she is about this. Like, she's obsessed with the fact that she's not as young and beautiful as she was when she was 20.
And so, she's not a crone. Like, it's not a crone figure where,
So it does seem like champagne problems, you know?
It's right.
Like, I mean, you're fine. Like, why are you going to make a deal with Dracula? Like, to be slightly better looking.
right. It's a nice horror trope. You got to make a deal with somebody worse than you can imagine for some mm-hmm. dumb thing.
Right.
And so she's not afraid to see the Lord of Vampires on her balcony. Quite the opposite, in fact. She invites him in, knowing that that's what a vampire has to do in order to you know, cross a threshold. And she says that she believes there's much they can offer each other. And this story is to be dracontinued.
Oh, nice.
So, solid episode of Tomb of Dracula. And this series is just like already there's a supporting cast. It's picking up steam. Frank Drake is the least interesting part of the book, but everything else is awesome. Yeah, and Dracula is phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
I love him. Yeah.
It's also got a lot of the sort of Hammer horror things where there's descendants of Van Helsing, descendants of Dracula, you know, those kinds of I just love seeing that stuff pop up.
Well, yeah, and it makes you feel like you're getting into this world, like you're coming in a chapter or two too late, which feels good. You know, because it feels lived in already. You're like, oh, these are the kids of where the action was. Like, what was the action? You know?
Right. Yep. You just get glimpses of it.
Right.
So that is Tomb of Dracula. That's pretty much it for these monster comics. We're going to take one final break and then we'll wrap this thing up. So stay tuned. We'll be back with more Monster by the Month right after this. All right. Welcome back to Monster by the Month. Fellas, I think that pretty much wraps up this episode of what we're doing here tonight.
Wait, Brian, what's that sound?
Hmm?
Is that a motorcycle in the distance? Do you hear it? And do I smell the sulfurous stench of hellfire? Yes! It's the first appearance of Marvel's Satan-fueled stunt cyclist, Ghost Rider.
Oh, he's here finally. Finally, yes. The star of the Marvel Universe. The monster universe has made his appearance.
Yeah. Oh boy. I'm so excited.
Well, before you walk us through this, Rob, let me just talk a little bit about the history of the character of Ghost Rider. This is actually the second Marvel character named Ghost Rider. The first one was a 19th century gunfighter based on the magazine Enterprise's character Ghost Rider, a.k.a. Rex Fury.
Wow.
You thought that was a good name. Created by writer Ray Crank.
Oh my God, what is happening? I think I'm time traveling.
And artist Dick Ayers for editor Vincent Sullivan in 1949.
Whoa.
The character appeared in horror-themed Western stories up until the Comics Code showed up and ruined everyone's party. And then they retired the character. Once the trademark to the character lapsed, Marvel Comics debuted its own nearly identical horror-free version of the character in Ghost Rider number one.
Huh.
And that was cover dated February 1967, plotted and drawn by the original Ghost Rider artist Dick Ayers, and writers Gary Friedrich and Roy Thomas. Once the other Ghost Rider made his debut this month, the one we're about to talk about, Marvel retroactively changed the name of their Western character. First, they called him Knight Rider.
Wait.
With an N.
Okay.
But then it was pointed out to them that Knight Rider was a term used by the Ku Klux Klan. They changed it to Phantom Rider, and they still use that character to this day.
So, was he the one in Mockingbird?
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
Yeah, that's him, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep. So he's like dressed all in white. He looks like a ghost cowboy, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Ghost cowboy.
That's great. Rex Fury
and Ray Crank.
written by Ray Crank. Well, now I sound like the SNL guy. I
was Don Pardo. Don Pardo, Richard Nixon, and the man thing walk into a bar. this Ghost Rider isn't a completely original creation either. He has some similarities to a short-lived feature published by Skywald Publication called Hell Rider, which I think we may have mentioned in one of our little historical recaps. But Hell Rider lasted for only two issues in 1971. It starred the titular vigilante motorcyclist, a Vietnam War veteran, lawyer, and black belt martial artist. That's a triple threat.
Wow. He gets up very early in the morning. That's a lot of things to accomplish in a day.
That's like three Van Dams.
Yeah. I mean, also, his name is Brick Reese. So if you're a Brick Reese, you can do all of those things. And
Brick Reese.
Hell Rider rode a customized flamethrower equipped motorcycle and had temporary super strength courtesy of an experimental drug. The stories featured scantily clad rock starlets, nightclub waitresses, and pot smoking 70s chicks, all quickly losing what little clothing they wore. The series was created by Gary Friedrich again, who would go on to co-create the supernatural motorcyclist Ghost Rider. And it's illustrated by the veteran team of Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito. So,
wow.
So that's how we got to this character. And now, Rob, I'm very excited for you to tell us, what does the Ghost Rider do once he gets to the Marvel Universe?
Well, oh boy. We get to see the cover of, and that already gives it away, but the splash page is even better. The story opens with a flaming skull-headed figure riding a motorcycle through a downpour. So his outfit is like, basically what we would think of as sort of like the modern sort of Scarlett Johansson shield outfit.
Yeah. You know,
like,
okay.
Very I'm similar glad you to said that, that yeah. Black Widow kind of thing, like skin tight leather suit with a weird belt and just looks cool. Popped collar.
Yep. As they say in the Suicide song, baby, 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 baby. He's looking so cute riding around in a blue jumpsuit.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Riding through your town with his head on fire. And so he rides past an armed robbery taking place. And as the robbers murder their victim, they decide that they'd better follow the biker who witnessed it and get rid of him because he might be able to identify them. So they get in their car. They start pursuing the Ghost Rider. Eventually, they corner him in an alleyway. Ghost Rider creates a wall of hellfire between them by pointing his finger. And then he stunt jumps over them to escape. I love that. Just unnecessarily make the wall, jump over the wall and right. them. Because
yeah. And also the internal monologue of yeah. the Ghost Rider. Yeah. Were you going to mention that, Jay?
I was. It's really strange because he's like, oh, no, don't let them see me. Like, he's very like nervous and like on the run. Like he seems like the scared one.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
This is his inner monologue until he, you know, once they corner him, then he's like, I'm more trouble than you can imagine, especially right. when he is the servant of Satan. Like he's definitely saying a bunch of crazy, cool, spooky things. But inside his head, he's just like worried that is like it's going to get past midnight and he's going to turn back into, you know, I don't know. He seems so nervous and Peter Parker-ish.
Yeah. yeah, I was very surprised that the first thought that you or the first words that come from him is like, why now? I can't let anyone see me, not like this. Have to shake them somehow, keep them from seeing what's happened to me. It's just yeah. like it sets up this like a very interesting story from a man with a flaming motorcycle. I mean, flaming skull head.
Yeah, yeah. it's already much richer than you would guess.
Imagine. Yeah, 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 exactly.
So yeah, and if you're more familiar with like the later versions of the Ghost Rider, the only thing that's on fire here is his skull. Like the bike is just a regular chopper.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I mean, it's a nice chopper.
It's a great chopper.
Yeah.
Yep.
He finally manages to lose them after his jump and changes back to stunt cyclist Johnny Blaze as the sun comes up. So still wearing exactly the same outfit, just a dude with blonde hair, white guy. And he is angsty galore. So Blaze heads to Madison Square Garden, where he's scheduled to attempt the world motorcycle jump record. that evening. And in his dressing room, he thinks back to how his life took a turn for the demonic. His father was a stunt writer for Crash Simpson's cycle show and died in a flaming wreck when Johnny was just a boy.
All of these people, like, names are destiny in this story. Right?
Very much so.
Johnny Blaze, watch out for Crash Simpson. He might not stay on his bike. Johnny was adopted by Crash and his wife Mona and became part of their family with their daughter Roxanne, who is also known as Rocky.
And made entirely of stones.
No, not yet. But it seems like that's her destiny. So Johnny eventually overcame his fear of motorcycles, and it looked like he was going to join the cycle show until tragedy struck again when he was 15. While practicing with Rocky, his bike caught on fire. He rode it out of the tent and accidentally crashed it into a tree. And when Mona came running to check on him, the bike exploded, leaving her near death. And on her deathbed, Mona made Johnny promise that he'd never ride in the show, which, of course, Johnny promised he would not do because he's not a demon or a monster or anything.
Right? No. He's a good boy.
And then 5 years pass, and Crash and Rocky think that Johnny's just a coward for not riding since the day Mona died. They both are just really on his case.
Yeah.
It's kind of tough. You're like, why would you at some point just don't hang around them anymore? Or, you know, you're 20 now.
First, you're 20. Second, like, are they really having a hard time understanding why one might be traumatized after, you know, that
the
experience?
The flaming exploding by
seeing
motorcycle?
Your surrogate mother explode in front of you because of a motorcycle wreck, you know, and losing your dad to a motorcycle crash. It's like, you know, maybe after a certain point, you're like, I don't know if this is for me.
Right, right.
I'll still hang out and be helpful to the show, but I'm not going to ride the bike, you know?
And they just can't get their heads around it.
Yeah.
But he figures out a loophole. He can ride his motorcycle, just not in the show.
Take that, Mona's ghost.
Yeah. So then he's just practicing riding his motorcycle. Like he's doing insane, like handstands on it and stuff. And
just his feet break the panel on that page.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like that.
And I've seen people do this because my stepbrothers and my brother did a bunch of dumb motorcycle stuff. So I saw stunt people before they did races and stuff. They would do, you know, the warm up would be like a stunt person doing insanely dumb things on a motorcycle and not dying.
Rocky, that's a better show. It's a better show if they don't.
Right. Also in the races, things get worse. But because everybody's named Crash eventually. Rocky sees him practicing while he's doing all these stunts, not in the show, realizes he's not a coward. And finally, Johnny tells her about his deathbed promise to her mother. Seems like Johnny could also have just communicated that at any point.
Yeah.
But we don't get enough angst, so he's got to keep that secret. Crash's show continues to get bigger and bigger until they're finally offered a show at Madison Square Garden, the biggest showcase in the world. But the news doesn't bring Crash any joy. His doctor, Doc Warren, has given him a month to live at most.
So I want to wonder if this is the same Doc Warren that is Peter Parker's professor. Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy's professor, who later winds up doing some experimentation.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So it turns out Crash has got the disease. And it's going to get him.
Always the disease is getting people.
The disease is the worst. If only he had a son to take over the show
instead of his useless daughter.
Yeah,
who's also totally loyal and competent at riding a motorcycle.
And can do all the stunts. So Johnny has to refuse again because of his deathbed promise to Mona, and now Crash and Rocky both think he's a coward again, even though Rocky knows about the promise. So here we are. How to get out of this? Johnny has a plan, and that plan is Satan.
That's quite a leap. Quite a leap.
I love that Satan's not like plan C or D or E. It's like, plan A, Satan.
Yep. And it's not an easy plan either. Within days, so he had to do a lot of book reading, I think. Johnny figures out how to summon the devil.
Can we just talk about that panel, though?
Yes.
So at the bottom of page 13. Ooh, yeah. Spooky.
Oh yeah.
So this is immediately after Crash basically tells him to get the hell out. It's just a panel of Johnny reading in the dim light of a lamp with a pile of grimoires surrounding him and a skull.
Human skull next
to him. Yeah, a human skull on one of them. And he's saying out loud in a word balloon, just one word, Satan.
Right. So if you're walking down the hallway, you're walking by his room, you're like, wait, what? What's going on in there?
And then he thinks, yes, this is the only way. And even though I'm afraid, and then it just sort of trails off, but he just yells Satan. He figured it out. It's the plan. I'm sure he looked at other options.
I don't know if he did, because it happens real quickly after.
I think he just thinks it's the best option. You know, some people do. So Johnny figures out, you know, how to summon the devil and to extract a promise from him in exchange for his soul. Pretty standard stuff there.
Sure.
Johnny asks that Crash Simpson be spared from the deadly disease, which is killing him. So he does, by the way, successfully get himself a Satan. He has like a blood pentagram on his chest and more of a blood star, and is burning.
It's honestly pretty sloppy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I would have shown up for this kid.
He's burning like some incense or something on a, you know, ram's head or something, skull. So he's got a couple of cool things going on. You know, you might want to check it out if you're Satan. And
if it's a slow Satan day.
Yeah.
Well, plus he's a big Crash fan. So
yeah,
sure.
No, he was probably coming to see the show anyway.
He just wanted backstage passes.
It's like, he's a smart guy.
Yeah. We didn't really have monster trucks the way we do now. So,
right.
But of course, you know, Johnny asking for to Crash to be spared from the deadly disease, which is killing him. You can practically hear Satan snickering into his hand as he agrees to the deal. Sure, kid. So 3 weeks later, the Madison Square Garden show rolls around, and Crash is going to go for the world's cycle jump record if it's the last thing he does. And spoiler alert, it is. Crash's destiny.
Yeah.
Johnny's not sweating it because he knows that his good buddy Satan won't let Crash die.
Oh, what a cute little buddy comedy that would make.
But Johnny forgets that he only extracted a promise from the devil that Crash wouldn't die of the disease that's killing him.
Oh, should have been more specific.
Yep. So when Crash goes for the jump, it's a real good news, bad news situation. The good news is that he jumps about 18 or 19 cars. The bad news is that there are 22 cars in the row and he crashes and dies. So, blinded by rage and grief, Johnny grabs his bike and immediately attempts the same jump and lands it. Despite promising that he wouldn't do exactly that thing to everybody his whole life.
Right.
So, but now, you know, I guess he doesn't have a ton to lose except his soul. So Rocky can't believe that he'd do that immediately after her father just died attempting it, and she leaves the show to him. So she's offended that he did it.
Oh, yeah, because really, if he could have done it that whole time and chose not to, and her dad died doing it, that is kind of a middle finger to the family.
Yeah, and thanks to the devil, his disease would have been cured.
Right.
Yeah, so.
So Johnny should have broken his promise before.
Yeah.
After making a deal with the devil. But so,
he didn't play these cards in the optimal order.
He's right. Not the smartest.
Typical Marvel Johnny.
Yeah. he's pulling a real Johnny something. Yeah.
those Marvel Johnnies.
So back in his dressing room, the devil appears to Johnny Blaze, of course. And Johnny's all, what the hell, Satan? And Satan's all, read the fine print, which wasn't even really fine print. It was just a bad, bad wish, you dummy. And so the devil moves to claim Johnny Blaze's soul, saying, from this day forth, you will walk this earth as my emissary in the dark hours. And in the light, you will join me in Hades.
It's a cool panel, too.
Yeah, no, it's so, it felt like a great Gene Colan sort of, this is Ploog, but it felt, again, like that, you know, like him doing Doctor Strange or something. It's just grand. You know,
wildly expressionist.
I did briefly think the Satan eyes were like fairy wings for a second.
I did too.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're just in the wrong spot. Like they should be a little bit higher, I think.
Or they should look more like eyes.
Yeah.
Just a little, right. Yeah.
Instead of like crushed sideways condoms.
you and your condoms today.
He's 20 years old. You know, looking out for the kid.
He doesn't want to get the disease.
Exactly.
Well, he's alone in his room with his, you know, adoptive-ish sister, stepsister. And she bursts in through the door, recites an invocation that forces the devil to leave, muttering that he's like, I'll be back for what's mine. And how did she know how to do that? She says, I read your books on Satan when you weren't around. And when I entered the room, well, I knew exactly what to do.
Wow.
So he should have even talked to her before he made this deal. She might have had a few pointers, like, be highly specific. And no matter what you do, it's Satan. You're the devil works in dependable ways. You will get
right. It's not surprising.
Yeah. The next night, Johnny is back in his dressing room. His head starts throbbing and he's burning up with a fever or a flaming skull. He transforms into the Ghost Rider and runs out of the building past some roadies who pretend that they didn't see a flaming skeleton in a motorcycle leathers running That's through nice the hallway. Touch. Yeah, I mean, they work for a stunt show. Weird stuff happens.
That was like maybe my favorite panel. Yeah. It's like, hey, what the devil's that? I don't know about you, but I'm going to pretend I didn't see a thing.
Yeah,
it's like to all appearances, it looks like a guy on fire running down a hallway. It's like, right. Jesus, should we like grab a blanket or something?
They're just like, we got boxes to move, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have time
for that.
Yeah.
So this has been going on for 3 weeks. Johnny rearranged the schedule so that all of his performances at Madison Square Garden are matinees. But he's terrified that the world will find out about his demonic secret and hunt him. He picks up a newspaper and learns that the killers that he escaped from told the cops about a mysterious Ghost Rider. He resolves to leave New York, but before he can do it, his noggin bursts into flame again, and he rides the streets of the Big Apple as the Ghost Rider. And this isn't the end. It's the beginning.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, man. There's so much. There's a bunch of blacklight posters in this comic. Last panel is a sweet blacklight poster.
So I think this is maybe the silliest of the Marvel monsters. Just because, I mean, the Satanic Panic stuff is so over the top.
Yeah.
But I think also it might be my favorite thing that we read in this batch, just because it's so ridiculous and it leans in so hard to its premise. It's like, yeah it's the devil. Like, we're not going to dick around.
It's not
with
even
this.
Mephisto. I mean, it is Satan. Like, as far as we know, reading this, he just called on Satan, made a deal with the devil, the devil. Now his head catches on fire. But I also love, of course, all of the stunt stuff. Like, this is playing into the Evel Knievel era, and I was, you know, this was still going on when I was a kid, but it was just starting. Like, we've talked about it before in the history pieces, but Evel Knievel's been doing all kinds of crazy stunts already. It's big news. There's a bunch of people, daredevils, not that daredevil, doing all kinds of weird stunts, and making a good living doing it. But, you know, highly risky and dangerous living. So I love that that's also the premise and part of the Ghost Rider, is that he rides a motorcycle because that's what he does during the day. His day job is riding a motorcycle.
Right.
It seemed like as a kid, just like the most perfect logic, not, of course, the logic of him deciding that the first option to help his ailing stepfather or adoptive father is to call on Satan, but you know, what are you gonna do? He's a dumb kid.
Yeah. I love that his entire costume is basically his work clothes and his skull on fire.
Right.
That's it.
There's no costume. Yeah, there's no costume. Like, he's not dressing like anything. This is just what he happens to be wearing when his skull
right. I feel like
goes on fire.
If he was wearing a bathrobe, it would just be like a skeleton with a flaming head.
right. Yeah. On a motorcycle. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he obviously has fleshy bits to fill out his leathers, but yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's great. And Ghost Rider is such a great visual too. Like, all props to Ploog for just nailing this. Like, it's awesome. It's a guy, he's dressed in like blue black leathers on a black motorcycle, and he's got a flaming skull. Like, it's terrific.
It's like, it's fully like, you don't have to have anything else. It's like, you say the name Motorhead and you're like, okay, I'm pretty sure what that is.
Exactly.
It just feels like heavy metal.
Like, it is like so an 8-year-old's conception of what they think a Hell's Angel looks like.
And, right.
And it's like, and I don't mean that to be like diminishing or anything. I don't mean to say that that's a silly thing or a stupid thing. It's like, I think it's perfect for comics, especially in this era. Like, this is like entry level horror, you know, it's like, it's the cool monster you root for.
It's a gateway drug.
Yeah. So,
yeah. And like, in and of itself, there's not a lot of scary elements. Like, we're not seeing a lot of horror tropes in this, but it's like, how comfortable are you with Satan stuff? Kind of, you know, like,
probably a test. Yeah.
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 Also that, kind of like what we were saying with Stan Lee and like their decision to launch Luke Cage as a thing. It's like, oh, there's a whole audience of people that we're not getting to, and we could if we just do a book for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about this? Here's a book for them. Like, there's a whole culture that we're not paying attention to. Here's one. Let's go for it.
Yeah.
I love this. All of the Satanism is so crazily over the top too. It's just, I didn't remember that. So that was refreshing and hilarious to see how, you know, I thought it was going to be handled still with sort of some, you know, deference to the comics code, where they're trying to dance around it. But I didn't remember it as such a, he just yells Satan and that's how he solves his problem.
That's so good. How often does
Satan appear in these books?
He's a regular supporting character.
He's a supporting character.
If this is the beginning of Satan, has a real good run in Marvel Comics in the 1970s.
Oh, that's great.
And there's like a bunch of different Satans. I mean, eventually I think a lot of them get consolidated, like retconned into being Mephisto or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just like, I mean, God, we're going to get to Damon Hellstrom, the son of Satan. Like, and it's like right there in big letters on the front of the book, you know? So,
yeah, it's going to get harder and harder to read that Submariner title. I'm telling you, every one of these crazy new things that come out, it's like,
unless Atlantean Satan shows up.
Yeah.
Ooh, cool. See, now you're talking. That's a great idea. Marvel, call us.
Yeah. So. Marvel, call us again.
Yep. Well, fellas, this has been a blast. But sadly, for real this time, this is the actual end of our seventh season. We played a little trick on you. But we wanted to bring you a nice little Halloween surprise. So, you know, as we said last episode, season 8 is going to start in the first week of January. We are very much looking forward to all the stuff that approximately 1972 through 1975 is going to bring our way.
Mm-hmm. Including, one of our births happens in there.
Yes, of that's the hosts, true.
That might be me.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up, Rob. One of the things I meant to mention in our April 1972 episode is that, that was the month that you were conceived.
True.
How do you want to talk about that a little bit? Like, how do you think that went? Like,
I assume there was some kind of Satan involved, but, and not condoms.
Just someone sitting alone in a room shouting Satan.
And nobody shouting condoms. And then bam, next thing you know, 9 months later.
Oh, it's like little baby Groot, like little baby Rob. Fully formed, just tiny.
It's almost 10 pounds, but you know,
not that tiny,
not that tiny.
So season 8 will be the birth of Rob. Season 9 will be the birth of me. I think season like 16 or 17 will be the birth of Jamie. So, we're coming up on a lot of these great milestones. We're looking forward to bringing them all to you once we've had a nice long nap, and have rested our weary eyes and come back, fresh and recharged and new guests and returning guests and all sorts of good stuff in the future. So, but you know, if you're getting lonely between now and then, if you're not already a Patreon subscriber, consider doing it, because you will get a bunch of exclusive bonus content showing up in the Patreon feed between now and the end of the year, including extended episodes from the pre-Patreon days, which could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, they're super good. I listen to them because I am a Patreon and I enjoy the bonus feed on a weekly basis.
I love that you went from listener to guest to co-host. Like you've been through the whole thing. It's a weird evolution.
Now we can't promise that if you're a Patreon supporter that you'll eventually wind up being a host. We wouldn't want to promise that because that may turn off more people that it brings in. But, you know, I was saying it's happened before. It's happened before.
You could be a guest. I mean, that's possible.
It's possible. Anything's possible, yeah, really.
People are saying it.
Yeah, people are saying it. So yeah, if you're not already a subscriber, there's no better time to become one than right now. It's just $4 a month at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth. And that will ensure that we will remain in your ears through the end of the year. Review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to listen to us. And if you'd like some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Got a review from Ben Grimm recently.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I didn't even know he knew we were doing this thing. But, you know, he's such a man of the people. It's such a pleasure to hear from Mr. Grimm. Find us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month. MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. Thank you so much for listening to Monster by the Month. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Winger.
We'll see you next year for next month. Until then, happy Halloween and stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics if you dare.